across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
We got a copy of the minutes, which summarise one view of what went on between Michelle O'Neill and Paula Bradshaw, the chair of that executive committee. It's all spelt out on the programme this morning. A very sad story from the family of Mr. Miskimmon, who sadly has now died after life support was withdrawn from him. That is spelt out today on the programme, the family giving us an exclusive interview. And then tonight, 5:30, do you know what we've been talking about? How there's been traffic disruption, traffic congestion, people sitting hours in traffic. Well, there's a football match tonight, and the Parades Commission have given permission for fans who want to march up lots of the arterial routes, Shaftesbury Square to Windsor Park. It's going to have an impact on Boucher Road. It's going to have an impact on Donegal Road, leaving onto the M1. Parades Commission have given permission for this. So the police are warning that there could be bedlam tonight at 5:30. What time's 5:30? Peak time traffic. How do we get home? Nobody's telling us. I have no idea. Get a tent. All coming up this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. It's all go at the co in here this morning. We've just got the minutes. Within the last few minutes, we've got the minutes, actually, from a controversial meeting between a Stormont committee chair and the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, a few hours, if you remember, before the First Minister went in to give evidence last month. The evidence session last month was supposed to scrutinise Michelle O'Neill over her party's handling of child safeguarding issues and other scandals which hit the party in recent months. It descended into what many have described as chaos, this meeting, with the First Minister accused of not answering questions about how the party handled issues around its former press officer, Michael McMonagall, and Michelle O'Neill was saying, look, I've answered these questions many, many times. And the First Minister was disputing whether it was appropriate to ask some of those questions in that committee meeting. Now, it unfolded that the chair, Paula Bradshaw, had met with Michelle O'Neill very, very shortly before the meeting happened. And some people were asking if that was appropriate. And more to the point, they wanted to know what was discussed. And Paula Bradshaw was describing it as normal, and that no detail was discussed that would have been inappropriate. That then, of course, begs the question, where were the minutes? Paula Bradshaw said that she did not take minutes, but someone in the executive office did. And we now have those minutes, which we're going to post, and we've just got them. So we're going to post these on my Twitter feed within the next few minutes. Let me read to you some of what is in this document. It says, areas discussed. The First Minister referenced the correspondence to the committee chair, which outlined the intended purpose of the meeting. That was, quote, to ensure the committee meeting was constructive and contributed to the positive working relationship between ministers and the committee. That the First Minister's attendance at the meeting is productive and conducted consistent with the statutory remit of the committee, which should be confined to the statutory functions which the First Minister exercised jointly, and that matters outside the functions and responsibilities of the executive officer beyond the legal remit of the committee. The First Minister, these minutes say, acknowledged that previously in answering questions in these matters, the lines had been blurred to some extent and expressed concern at the potential negative impact the situation could have on the integrity of the joint office and the wider institutions which she wished to protect. The chair confirmed that the committee had received legal advice and that she would ask committee members if they were willing to share it with TEO ministers. The chair explained that the First Minister was scheduled to appear for 45 minutes, and so it goes on about the timings of this. The chair confirmed that in respect of questions that may fall outside of the theories, the chair cannot stop the questions being asked. It's for the First Minister to decide whether to answer them or not. The chair may ask a member to revise a question to fit with the remit, and if questioning becomes repetitious or aggressive, the chair will intervene. Now, that
That's all. I can't see much in that. Maybe other guests that are going to come on this morning will, around, is there anything controversial in that? The next paragraph within these minutes, discussion was held on the questions which had been submitted. It was noted that some were tenuously linked to the work of TEO, e.g. safeguarding, where the policy responsibility belongs to DOH. Now, it'll be interesting to see what people think of that. Discussion was held on the questions which had been submitted. So should the chair of any committee in Stormont be discussing questions that had been submitted to her? And what does discussing mean? It's vague in those minutes. Discussion was held. Well, what type of discussion? Did Michelle O'Neill ask for undertakings? Doesn't say. Did Paula Bradshaw give them, refuse to give them? It doesn't say. So it's very, very vague. And I've seen in my career, certainly in the past, where minutes have been so vague that you don't know what was discussed. So I'm certainly wondering, what does that mean? Discussion was held on the questions which had been submitted. The minutes say there was also some discussion on the media reports from that morning, which suggested some members intended to ask questions outside of the committee's remit. Were the committee members given a heads up that this was a concern? Discussion was held, says the minutes, on the concerns the Assembly staff had expressed regarding the First Minister appearing specifically relating to the jointery of the office, which had been mitigated with confirmation that the Deputy First Minister had agreed to the First Minister's attendance. Again, discussion was held. What discussion? What was said? The Permanent Secretary raised the potential of delaying or postponing the session, seeking committee agreement to hold the meeting in closed session or with the committee's legal support present. Both the First Minister and Chair agreed the meeting should proceed in open session as planned. So again, the Permanent Secretary raised the potential of delaying or postponing the session, seeking committee agreement. Well, the committee never got a chance to agree or disagree. Permanent Secretary suggests it. Michelle O'Neill and the Chair decide that it should go ahead in open session. Let's get reaction to this. The DUP's Brian Kingston with us this morning. Good morning to you, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen.
Look, a lot of the detail of this, the public will be thinking, what on earth's going on here? This is about transparency in Stormont. This is about what is happening behind the scenes? Is it recorded properly? Are you comfortable with what you're hearing this morning?
Well, first of all, I haven't seen those minutes. I mean, the Committee for the Executive Office met yesterday afternoon, and we were told that the minutes were not yet provided by the Minister's office, by the First Minister's office. So you've seen minutes that the committee has not seen, despite being told 2 weeks ago that those minutes would be provided to us. We expected them to be included in our pack yesterday, and they were not. So at the meeting yesterday, I did put on the record, I expressed my deep disappointment at the conduct of the First Minister at that meeting on the 23rd of October. For context, yesterday we were talking about some of the religious institutions which have yet to engage with officials over historical institutional abuse of children. And we are seeking to bring some of those institutions before the committee. And there's questions for them about redress, about making financial contributions, about proper apologies, about a memorial. And some of those institutions are resisting that. So we very much have child safeguarding at the heart of the work of the department and the committee. And what happened over McMonagle and Niall O'Donoghue is entirely relevant to that. And we see very strong parallels where if we are, as a committee and as elected representatives, wanting to hold institutions to account for their conduct and failings around safeguarding, that we, those of us in political parties and as elected representatives, must expect and the same scrutiny of our actions, and where there has been failings, that should be acknowledged. And that is my frustration throughout this, that Sinn Féin have not acknowledged their failings. They've tried to limit the responsibility to a small number of individuals lower down the organisation, the leadership has not taken ownership of their failings and their attempt to cover this up.
Can I ask, though, Brian, for your party's view on discussion was held on the questions which had been submitted. Should that be happening between a chair and a witness? And it's genuinely an open question because I don't know. I'm trying to find out this morning.
Yeah, well, I know some have said, why were some questions, some sample questions submitted in advance?
Well, you wrote some of them.
Yeah, indeed I did. So the First Minister, Deputy First Minister and Junior Ministers had attended a scheduled appearance at the committee on the 2nd of October. And by the end of that, and at that meeting on the 2nd of October, I had raised questions relating to Michael McMonagle, and that story had only just broken at that stage. And again, concerns were being raised about a story that was being put forward again about people in Sinn Féin not having noticed him, you know, at events at Stormont and Westminster in his new capacity of British Heart Foundation, and the references from press officers which enabled him to get that post. So the First Minister did answer questions that I posed at that meeting on the 2nd of October.
But here's the pertinent point.
The story had changed, and Sinn Féin had changed their position on a number of matters, so I had asked for the First Minister to be brought back. And because we were making that request only 2 weeks after her appearance, it was relevant to provide a context and a rationale for that request.
And you said this on BBC One and Nolan Live with me, and I understand that. My question this morning, Brian, is having submitted those questions, and you knew that Michelle O'Neill had seen them, were you under the impression when you were sitting in that open committee that Michelle O'Neill was answering the questions clean as it was in terms of your, clean in terms of your understanding? Questions had been submitted, First Minister was answering them, rather than there had been a discussion about those submitted questions between the chair and the witness.
Well,
Did you know that?
No, we didn't. We were given 10 minutes notice by email that there would be a meeting between the First Minister and the chair of the committee. So while some sample questions had been submitted, the committee had met the day before and had been made clear at that committee meeting that members of the committee have the right to ask supplementary questions as they see relevant to the matter, and that would happen, and that it would be up to the First Minister to decide whether or not she answered questions. We have a responsibility on behalf of the public to ask probing questions relating to safeguarding, because there has been damage to public confidence in the oversight of child safeguarding through these matters. So there's no doubt in my mind that the First Minister, in requesting and obtaining that meeting with the chair in advance, was wanting to put pressure on the chair to effectively police the questions and rule them out of order, even though the First Minister knew.
Well, Michelle O'Neill would deny that, wouldn't she?
Requesting her to come back.
She would deny that. And Paula Bradshaw herself has said, look, this is a normal course of business. Mick Field, the editor of Slugger O'Toole, with us this morning as well. Good morning to you, Mick.
Morning, Stephen.
Well, we've got these minutes now. And look, maybe they show Mick a meeting so that the subsequent meeting would gather as much information for the public as possible within the confined 45 minutes. What about the discussion, this term discussion, of the questions submitted? Should that be happening?
I mean, it's hard to get the context of how that discussion was taking place. And remember, minutes are not verbatim notes. They're not, they don't include everything. They're supposed to be a summary of what went on. And that's why the catch-all term discussion
exactly
doesn't really
reveal
very much.
What does that mean? What does it mean?
Well, not very much. You know, look, I mean, the TEO, as they're calling it, the Executive Office, its predecessor, OFM-DFM, it was similarly caught out, sometimes not taking any notes of internal meetings that had taken place. And you've got to wonder whether these minutes were taken contemporaneously or whether they were put together after the fact. I don't think there's anything in this particular set of minutes that particularly compromises the chair. We don't know what those discussions were. We do know, though, that the chair made it very, very clear that the committee was not, as the FM tried to claim during that meeting, was not restricted in the questions it could ask. The First Minister was certainly, and this is noted in the minutes, and it was noted by the Vice Chair during that stormy meeting, the First Minister is not obliged to answer any of the questions, but that's not how either the First Minister or her party colleague in the Carolyn Quillen on the committee played it. They tried to tell fellow members of the committee between them that they had no right to ask certain questions. Now, that's not a rule anybody's ever heard of before. It's certainly not a rule that their party colleagues in Dáil Éireann follow when they're calling the Southern government to account. And it's frankly quite a ridiculous line to have taken. And the net effect is that between them, Carol McQuillan and the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, has basically, it looks to me, sought to undermine the committee's ability to ask specific questions in order to get specific answers. If the committee is not there to do that, what on earth is the point of any of these scrutiny committees? And is the SDLP...
Well, I guess Karen McCullen and indeed Michelle O'Neill, Mick, would say, look, there was a particular function in the context of Sinn Féin had answered questions outside of that meeting. There was a particular remit for that meeting. They would argue that, wouldn't they?
Well, and reasonably. Clearly... clearly, that is for the look. There's no hard and fast rule about where that concern begins and ends. You know, there's the question of confidence. There were questions raised, quite legitimate questions raised about the employee, Michael McMonagall, who was temporarily only for 2 months back in 21, I think it was. That McMonagall was a direct employee for Michelle O'Neill, now, albeit before she was First Minister. The point is, these are quite specific questions. The First Minister is not obliged to answer them, but she's also not entitled to turn around and say, you cannot ask that question. It's just ridiculous, because she's setting down boundaries that are effectively political boundaries. She doesn't want to answer them. She doesn't want to be seen.
And to be fair
to
Paula Bradshaw, she refused to accept that, right?
Well, she did. She did. Although what happened, the behaviour of Nicholan and O'Neill between the two of them was set up to actively whether it was set up to actively undermine it, that is exactly what happened. That's indisputable. And the whole thing just
They would vehemently deny that now, that they were actively undermining anything.
Well, of course.
No, they were there. You know, First of all, they turned up. Secondly, they were answering questions. And Carolyn Quillen's quite entitled to express any opinion that she has and allow the chair to rule on it, Mick.
Yes, but what I'm saying is her aggressive, continual interventions made it almost impossible for the chair to continue chairing that. And for to get some focus on not simply the questions that were asked, but some answers. Yeah, you know, the SDLP member of the committee basically said, look, there has to be a forum where we can ask these questions. There has to be a place. And if it's not this committee, which the First Minister is directly responsible to, where is that other place? And thus far, there's been no answer to that question.
Brian Kingston, the other question I have in my head here, again, is about process. In that you have these minutes taken by the Executive Office. Should the minutes be taken by the Chair's office? Or what is the procedure around all this?
Yeah, well, that came up yesterday. We were disappointed. We had been told that minutes from the Minister's office would have been provided by now, and you have them. The committee doesn't have them. But in any such situation, yes, the Chair and the clerks to the committee should also be taking a minute, because, as I've said before, it's important to recognise that the committee is independent of the department and the minister. The committee is a scrutiny committee and is an instrument of the assembly as a whole for public accountability. So the committee clerks should take their own minute of the meeting. There should be two sets of minutes because there's two different parties involved, the minister represented and the committee represented. At our committee meeting yesterday, it was agreed by committee members in discussion about this that the chair of the committee should not be meeting with any minister in such a situation in advance of the meeting, if it is a matter of the minister coming to the committee for scrutiny questions.
Well,
because of how this matter unfolded, and again, the appearance that the minister was actually using that pre-meeting put pressure on the chair to prevent questions being asked.
Well, she would deny that. She would absolutely deny that. The TV's Timothy Gaston.
Well, that's what happened. That's what happened.
Well, actually, it wasn't what happened because you're saying she refused to answer questions. That means the questions were asked. So it means that
and she was refusing to answer, saying that, well, that's not under the remit of the committee. And as Mick has said,
so any pressure suggesting, which was Ms. Michelle Lee would deny, that she was putting pressure for questions not to be asked. The whole point is those questions were asked, and that is what enables you to allege she refused to answer them. The TV's Timothy Gaston with us this morning. Morning, Timothy.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, look, these minutes show Paula Bradshaw laying out the terms here with which the meeting that you were then present at was going to happen. Was going to occur. Discussion was held on the questions which had been submitted. What do you make of that?
Oh, Stephen, where to begin? Certainly there should have been no questions submitted to a witness prior to coming to committee. That was a first to begin with. But to now discover, when we were told that it wasn't the case, to now discover that the questions that were submitted were discussed in this private meeting before coming to committee just makes this situation 10 times worse.
Well, that term is so broad. Discussion was held on the questions which had been submitted. It was noted that some were tenuously linked to the work of TEO, e.g. safeguarding, where the policy responsibility belongs to DOH. What did the chair say? What was the chair's ruling? Minutes are supposed to record decisions. So what did the chair say about the questions that had been submitted? Guess what? The minutes don't tell us.
Yeah, and that's it. It's left this whole grey area. I told the chair before we went into the committee meeting that I believe she had compromised herself by going to this private meeting. I reminded her of that yesterday during committee.
You did remind her, and she reminded you that it's you, in her view, that's trying to disrupt these committees.
Well, Stephen, I think this is a big story. There's a lot of public interest in this. There's a lot of grey areas. People want the truth. Absolutely. Like, you're running this story ahead of your programme this morning. So there's obviously an interest from you, and you realise the importance of this. This is all about scrutiny. This is all about trust. This is all about transparency. And this has sadly been lacking from the very beginning of this scandal.
Look, if there aren't rules at these committees, then it's just a free-for-all. There need to be rules at these committees.
Well, absolutely. There's rules to adhere to. But let's go back to the minutes. So the minutes appear to be, the whole thrust of them is about being constructive at the committee. It's not about getting to the truth. So that is a fundamental flaw of this private meeting that took place. The chairperson, in my view, should have been going in there with an intention. The First Minister's coming to give evidence.
Well, you're stretching that, aren't you? Being constructive is about getting to the truth in the context of these meetings.
No, it's not. It's not. It's about coming in, ticking a box and letting the First Minister away after 45 minutes. The First Minister should have been invited to come to the committee and stay there for the length of time it was required to get to the truth. Not about being constructive and ticking the box and letting...
She's running the country.
..out the door.
She's running the country. What leader comes in with an undefined time in their diary with which they can do a meeting? Like, that's just ridiculous, Timothy, isn't it? You can argue that the 45 minutes was too short, too long, whatever, but you cannot argue that the leader of a country just clears their diary for the whole day.
If this was classed as an important issue... to build confidence back and trust back from the whole scandal that has taken place. Would you not have thought that would have been a priority? It's been a priority in your show to cover this story, so it should have been a priority for the First Minister to come into committee, be open and honest and transparent, and answer all the questions. The questions
who was trying to get in there?
All the...
Sorry, somebody else.
Me, Stephen. Look.
McFeely.
The reason Timothy has isolated constructive isn't that it came from the chair, it came from the First Minister. Right. And we don't know where the 45 minutes came from, but the idea that the one body that the minister is responsible to, which is the committee, which is acting in on behalf of the whole assembly, cannot give more than 45 minutes is a ridiculous nonsense. In the Republic, in Dáil Éireann, there are three sessions a week of leaders' questions, and the minister, the Taoiseach, has to stay there until the leader of every single party, and there's lots of them now.
But the point is, Michelle O'Neill had already sat in front of Stormont.
Doesn't matter. The Taoiseach sits in front of the Parliament three times a week and is asked specific questions, and if he doesn't give specific answers, then that story will rumble on and rumble on and rumble on. This was a clear attempt at closing down accountability, making sure that they had a time limit, which I don't know, Timothy can tell you whether they were told about this sufficiently far in advance or whether that was just part of the 10-minute warning situation. But it is ridiculous that a First Minister can behave in front of the committee that she is accountable to in such a cavalier and offhand way and try to tell them what their own rules were. And that's contemptible. It's contempt. It's an expression of contempt for the institutions that meeting notes there was concern about any damage to the her specific department or to the wider institution.
Well, these two paragraphs for me within these minutes, I'm going to repeat them again for fairness. Discussion was held on questions which had been submitted. It was noted that some were tenuously linked to the work of TEO, e.g. safeguarding where the policy responsibility belongs to Department of Health. The first thing that I'm noting there, and I'm not expressing opinion, but I'm absolutely reading this as fact. Look at what they're stating as fact within those minutes. It was noted that some of the questions which had been submitted were tenuously linked to the work of the Executive Office. Not it was discussed whether, it was noted that. So in other words, these impartial minutes written by a civil servant is noting as fact that some of
on
the questions
of the witness.
These minutes are not on behalf of the witness. These minutes are supposed to be factual.
It's the witness department.
Yes, but these
it's
minutes.
It's not our department. It wasn't the committee.
But hold on a minute.
You want to take me back? Let me make this point, Timothy.
Stormont,
that's not the case.
Let me
that
make
was
this
an oral.
Yes, but let
ahead.
Me let me make this point. These are arm's length, supposed to be arm's length minutes. So let's presume that they are recording what happened. This is suggesting, surely, that the chair agreed that the questions that the likes of you, Brian Kingston, had submitted were tenuously linked to the work of the TEO. Because it said it was noted. Noted by who? It's saying it was noted as fact.
Yeah. Well, the committee members, I mean, a number of committee members put forward sample questions. So it was very clear what the subject matter of the meeting was going to be. So to turn up knowing that we wanted to ask Matt questions about these safeguarding matters and then to declare, well, I'm not going to ask questions like on those matters, just made the meeting a nonsense. And it just exposed the evasion that Sinn Féin have exercised over this throughout. And the attempt to damage limitation and to restrict the sphere of responsibility, that apparently it was only the fault of two press officers, only the fault of an HR manager. Nobody else knew. Nobody at those two events, senior people in Sinn Féin, noticed McMonagle attending an event in its capacity with BHF. Their account just does not stand up to scrutiny. We attempted to ask the obvious questions, and she shut the questions down by refusing to answer.
There is another point here, and look, this maybe is procedure, so help me with this. Mick Fieldy, maybe you can, or Timothy Gasson, or Brian Kingston, or we can get somebody else. I'm noticing here, so this meeting occurred on the 23rd of October. The Nolan Show have the minutes in front of us now. We're publishing them on my Twitter feed at Stephen Nolan. At the bottom, it says the date that the note was written, that the minutes were written. And that's nearly a week later, the 28th of October. So should notes be taken and written contemporaneously? Or does that mean the person taking the minutes just notes down the key bits and then writes them up on the 28th? I don't know. And they were agreed by the Permanent Secretary on the 30th. So the meeting happens on the 23rd. This is saying they were written on the 28th and agreed on the 30th. Is that normal procedure?
Stephen, this just adds, you know, the farce says that the committee should have had its own minutes, and then we would have been content that it was our record that we were relying on, not the record of a witness. That them's questions I can't answer because they relate that it's the First Minister who has tried to evade every question that has been put to her.
She would deny that.
It's up to her to come forward and confirm, and her officials, if that's how they carry out business in the executive office.
Well, we've asked for the First Minister. We've also asked for Paula Bradshaw to appear. Do you know, Brian Kingston, in terms of when minutes... So there's someone sitting in that meeting taking the minutes. They're then written on the 28th.
Yeah. Well, that is a considerable gap. It was 5 days later. I mean, equally, we know people are busy, whatever, and maybe minutes don't always get written on the same day as a meeting. But 5 days later does make it sound that it only happened because the committee requested 4 minutes of that pre-meeting. Because after what happened at the meeting, we wanted to know what did happen at this pre-meeting, of which we were only given 10 minutes notice, and we had not approved. And as I say, at committee yesterday, we agreed that that situation should not arise again, that the chair of the committee should not be meeting with any minister coming as a witness.
The minutes also say there was some discussion of the media reports from the morning, which suggested some members intended to ask questions outside of the committee's remit. From memory, I think you, Timothy, were on the programme, and you, Brian, that morning. They certainly were in the Nolan Show. Some of you were. I think it was you, Brian. There was some discussion on the media reports from the morning. Well, what discussion? What does that mean? What's the point of these minutes if it's so broad you don't know what it's saying?
Yeah, well, we had made clear it was relating to safeguarding matters, and people will see an obvious hypocrisy if we're scrutinising religious institutions over their safeguarding feelings that political parties represented on the committee and ministers with responsibility for oversight are avoiding that scrutiny themselves. I mean, that's just an obvious hypocrisy, and we have tried to address that.
All right. Mick Fieldy, Timothy Gasson, thank you. Brian Kingston, before you go this morning, now we have you with us. Where's the state of play with the portrait at the City Hall, which was damaged?
Well, indeed, because I have seen some media reports suggesting that no one has been interviewed, which is astonishing. I have raised that question with senior police officers in Belfast. They have just told me that whilst they can't go into the detail of a live investigation, they've told me that it's proceeding at pace. They have suggested it's not correct that no one has been interviewed, but neither have they confirmed. It would be astonishing. We were told that... the Sinn Féin member, who subsequently left his employment with Sinn Féin, had been voluntarily interviewed. So I am going back to the police to ask, look, how is this progressing? Clearly, an individual has admitted his involvement. Has he been formally interviewed? We've also to hear from Sinn Féin what was his involvement with the party. Was he employed by an MLA? If so, who? And did he have other connections with the party?
Okay, Brian, thank you. Morning to you. Jason and Coleraine. Morning, Jason.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I watched that committee meeting, so I did, and there was Paula Bradshaw and Michelle O'Neill should never have met before that. It doesn't happen in any other committee meeting, so it does. And the other thing I would like to just say, why did the permanent secretary want that meeting only to be behind closed doors? And who signed off these minutes, these private minutes? Does anybody know?
Yes, the permanent secretary signed them off.
But where?
On the 30th. The permanent secretary. I have them in front of me. The permanent secretary signed them off on the 30th of October. The meeting was on the 23rd.
But why did it take that long? Did they just sit and make them up? Nobody. There was only two people at that private meeting. Three, well, if the permanent secretary was there.
No, there were others there as well. Michelle O'Neill was there.
A special
advisor from the executive office was there. The permanent secretary was there. The FMPPS was there. That's the private secretary, I would have thought. The permanent secretary was there. The committee chair was there. A clerk was there.
So it took a full week for all them people to make up a set of minutes. It took a week. That's what I'm saying. Did they all come together and just decide, this is what we're going to say here? I mean, after all, I watched that meeting, and Michelle O'Neill stonewalled that, and I watched all their meetings. She stonewalled every question for 45 minutes. In fact, Karen McQuillan done more talking than she did.
Let's just hear what Paula Bradshaw said. She's not available this morning, but here's some of what Paula said. She was chairing the meeting, the Alliance Party's Paula Bradshaw, when she appeared on Nolan Live on BBC One about the questions which had been submitted beforehand.
I had asked a question at the start around the damage to the Irish language community off the back of that incident in Belfast City Hall, and she...
Well, why didn't you shut your own question down?
Because I had couched mine in relation to the language bodies and the equality and protection for minority language rights that they have protection for. I asked the question and she answered in that regard, but she said she was not going to speak to any of the incidents from Saturday night. So she had been very clear she wasn't going to go there.
And did she have these discussions with you?
No, not at all. Not at all. Honest to goodness, I did not disclose any of the areas that I would be even remotely asking questions on.
We're going to see all this when we see the minutes.
No problem.
Can you just play the last 10 seconds that live for me, please? Just talking to our colleagues here behind the scenes. Just play the last 15 seconds where Paula talks about no discussions.
But she said she was not going to speak to any of the incidents from Saturday night. So she had been very clear she wasn't going to go there.
And did she have these discussions with you?
No, not at all. Not at all. Honest to goodness. I did not disclose any of the areas that I would be even remotely asking questions on.
We're going to see all this when we see the minutes.
No problem.
I did not disclose any of the areas that I would be asking questions on, says Paula Bradshaw. But the minute says discussion was held on questions which have been submitted. Now, that's questions submitted by others. That's Paula saying she did not discuss any questions that she would be asking, but clearly the questions that had been submitted by others, according to these minutes, were discussed beforehand.
Michelle O'Neill refused to answer questions. She said it out of her own mouth, or Paula Bradshaw said that she said refused to answer questions. So what was the point of going there in the first place?
Okay. Listen, Jason, thank you. I'm sure this will continue to be talked about. Thank you this morning and thanks to our guests. Let's move on. The heartbroken daughter of a man who was struck in County Antrim over the weekend and given a 1% chance of surviving has spoken of her devastation now that he has died. 74-year-old Tony Miskimmon was punched in the head and knocked unconscious in Antrim Town on Saturday night. Marcus Fleming appeared in court on Monday charged with grievous bodily harm. A police constable said he could connect the defendant to the case. After being arrested, the police officer said the defendant admitted to police that he hit Mr. Miskimmon but claimed he was hit first. Mr. Miskimmon's daughter, Lani, who lives in Australia, flew immediately to Northern Ireland where doctors broke the news of how badly damaged her father's brain was. They informed her yesterday that it was in her father's best interests to remove his ventilation. And Mr. MacSkimmon has now died. The family have been talking to the Nolan Show. I spoke to Lanny yesterday afternoon before that life support was withdrawn from Mr. MacSkimmon, and I began by asking her to tell me what happened.
So I live in Australia, in Perth, in Western Australia, and on Sunday morning I woke up at about 8 a.m. and looked at my phone and had a notification from a Facebook message from a name I'd never heard of, and it said, "Hello, I've been asked to contact you. Can you call Antrim Area Hospital?" And I looked at that phone message and thought, this is a joke, because my sister lives in Liverpool in the UK, and I thought if anything happened, this would come from my sister. So I jumped on Facebook very quickly, and there was another message from an acquaintance from my father, and it basically said, this is such and such. There's been an incident. Please call Antrim Area Hospital. Your dad's in the ICU. And so I called Antrim Area Hospital and got in touch with a consultant, Dr. Morrison, and he already was waiting for my phone call. And he said that he was trying to contact my father's next of kin, which was Nikki MacSkimmon, my sister. And she wasn't well, so she had turned her phone off, which never happened. And he basically was very, very nice to me and said, look, that he is seriously ill. And he said to me on the phone that there's a 1% survival rate of this.
Yeah.
He's got severe, he said to me, severe head injuries, bleed on the brain. What did he say? Fractured skull, fractured facial bones. And my first question was, is he, are you asking me for permission to turn off his life support? And he said, no, what we're going to do is, we're going to keep working with your father, but I'm a person, whereas I need to know everything. And I just said, is my dad going to make it? And he said, look, if he does come out of this, he is not going to have any quality of life. But if there is any quality of your life, it's going to be 1%. And so then I was able to get off the phone and call my sister. And she didn't answer, so I called her daughter, and I had to break the news to my sister that my dad was basically not going to make it.
And then you start wondering, well, how did this happen? What's happened to him?
Well, not only that, my dad is a big giant of a man. And I remember coming to Northern Ireland when I was a child and walking through turnstiles when the troubles were happening. And my dad's massive. Everyone knew, you know, Big Darby, Big Tony. And I felt safe. I've never, ever not felt safe. So for someone to turn around to me and said, you know, he's not going to make it, never in a million years would I have thought I'd have that call. And I really still thought it was a joke.
Can you tell me your understanding of what happened?
Okay, so my understanding is my dad has a is a very quiet man, he keeps to himself, but he's a character, but he doesn't, you know, he just likes to do his little routine. So every Saturday he loves to go down, he used to be a merchant seaman, and he loves going down the Dockers Club in Belfast. And I've never been here. I don't know any of this. I've not been to Antrim before, and I've not been to the Dockers Club. I left the UK when I was 19. So I've heard about this all my life. So every Saturday he goes to the Dockers Club. And I'd only spoken to him that day as well, around about, I think it was 11:30 in the afternoon. And he was on he's having his breakfast of sausage and egg. And he goes to the U Tree Cafe normally in Antrim. And he was getting ready to go to the Dockers Club for a few drinks. And he had come home, and I'm not sure if it was a bus or a train, when he fell as well. He inhaled the broken bones of his face, and then CPR was administered by the witnesses. There was a couple of witnesses, and the ambulance was called.
So when he fell to the ground,
yeah,
the broken bones,
there was blood everywhere,
he swallowed the the broken bones from inside
his
face.
Yeah. We got shown the brain scans yesterday of what a normal brain looks like and what my dad's brain looks like, and half of his brain is completely liquefied and there's bleeding on every layer of his brain. And the swelling is immense.
So tell me more about those brain scans. What did they show?
They show that a brain is supposed to be like, the outline is like a cauliflower. So it's very convoluted and bumpy. There should be a gap, like the cavity between the brain and the skull. There's a gap there full of fluid to allow the brain to be freely moving and, you know, shock absorbing. There's absolutely no free fluid between his skull and his brain. The brain has swollen so much that it's really smooth. The two sides of the brain, there's normally there's two sides of the brain that's connected right in the middle, but you'd think it was one solid piece. It's not. There was blood between those. There's two cavities within the brain. They were completely full of blood, and then they showed us a lateral scan where it went from the very top of his skull down to the base of his skull, and every layer was blood-filled, bleeding, catastrophic blood all over his brain. And my sister and I see that and we can see it, but we're still thinking, my dad is such a big man, strong man, that he's going to still come out of this. But they've told us that it isn't going to happen.
And we are recording this interview Wednesday lunchtime, so it will be before the morning of broadcast. When people are listening to this, it'll be Thursday morning. We're recording this on Wednesday lunchtime.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to your dad over the next few hours?
Over the next few hours, the doctors have decided that it's in my dad's best interest to try and remove sedation and take out his breathing tubes. Now, he is breathing a little bit on his own, but the removal of those breathing apparatus will cause two things. One, the removal of the breathing apparatus will allow him to die very, very quickly and peacefully because he cannot voluntarily support his own life. Or it's going to be a longer withdrawn out process, which I'm assuming is going to be distressing to watch. But, you know, his morphine he's going to be administered as much morphine that's legal to keep him comfortable, but to allow him to pass with as much dignity and pain-free as much as possible. And that process is going to be starting in the next few hours.
So up until now, people have been told in the news cycle about your dad that he had 1% chance of surviving. The conversation you're having with me now is that you expect your father to die today?
Yes. Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I can't believe that my massive, big, beautiful Hulk giant of a dad, who makes me feel protected and his girls and his grandson feel protected, is going to die. I never thought that this would be something I'd be doing 4 or 5 days ago.
And your dad has never regained consciousness, so
No.
What's been stolen from you is you've never had a chance to say goodbye to your dad, you and your sister.
No. Myself and my two children flew out to England this year in May, and my father got to see his two grandchildren that he's only met once before. All together. So we had his two girls, myself and my sister, together, and we had family time, which was, you know, now with, you know, hindsight, you know, thank God. We were planning to come to, you know, we were all planning to come and visit again because we had such a good time, but he was planning to come over next year to come and see and stay with us for a little bit. I only spoke to him, like I said, 11:30 a.m. your time, and we were talking about, you know, getting on the plane and coming over. We were talking about him, he's on his way to the Dockers Club, how much he loves the kids, and that he goes and visits Nikki quite a bit, my sister. And, you know, my dad has COPD, I ever thought something was going to happen to my dad, it would be, you know, from his lungs. I never thought this. Never.
Just finally, tell me about your dad and the fond memories you have of him.
I felt very proud being my dad. When I lived in the Alabama with my sister, everyone knew him as Big Darby, Big D, Tony, Tony Skimmin, big character.
Darby and the Little People.
They called him Darby because of the Darby and the Little People or something. I don't know if that's an Irish folk story. I'm not 100% sure. But in the Isle of Man, you know, everyone knew me because I was Darby's daughter. You know, I never felt threatened. I never ever went anywhere and thought that I couldn't, you know, walk safely around. I was a very confident kid because Dad looked after me. He liked to have a little drink in the pub and we'd walk in and, you know, people would always say, oh, you're Darby's daughter, you're Tony's daughter. And, you know, growing up, you know, Nikki and myself, we were, you know, he was just, you know, because of his size, people would look at him and think big, hard man, but he's a big softy, loved his girls, myself. When I refer to his girls, you know, it's like we're his, he just loved us. I never went a day without not knowing how much I was loved, even though I left us the UK at 19 and then my sister had her children and my dad just turned into this soft, gooey mess and just, oh my God, he loved his dogs. He loved my sister's dogs. He loved the kids. I arrived here Monday, midday, got in a taxi because we flew straight to Dublin and then because we couldn't get a flight to Belfast. And they said, oh, what are you doing, a tourist? And I said, oh, my dad. They said, oh, that man. And I said, yes. And I said, Tony Miskimmin. Not Tony Miskimmin. I know Tony. And every single taxi we've had to get between, we've had like four or five taxis a day. When I've mentioned what we're doing, every single person, oh, I know Tony. Oh, he lives here and he was my friend. What a lovely man. And everyone knows him. I just want people to know that this isn't a little frail old man. This is a big, strong man that is a gentle giant that had so many people that loved him. The first man I've ever loved. And, you know, his children and grandchildren are missing this amazing person. And I want the world to know how much this man means to me and my sister and my family.
Thank you, Lani. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's very sad. Ms. Miskimmin has subsequently died after we recorded that interview at lunchtime yesterday. Lani was back in touch with the Nolan team last night and she told us ventilation, this is the message she sent us. She said ventilation was removed at 2:20 yesterday. My dad fought with a strong heart and held a strong heart rate for 8 hours. And then very quietly and peacefully passed with no struggle at 10:20. As a true gentleman, we are beyond devastated. And that from the family of 74-year-old Mr. Miskimmin. Very, very sad story indeed. Well, look, we have lots of different stories coming in to the programme this morning. Just to flag up that motorists have been warned of significant traffic disruption that will potentially happen tonight. This due to a parade by hundreds of football fans from Switzerland. It's expected that up to 2,000 supporters of St Gallen are expected in Belfast tonight for this UEFA Conference League match at Windsor Park against Larne Football Club. I know that Paul Kennedy, is that? Phoned us a few minutes ago. Paul's a taxi driver and he's saying, look, can we investigate the traffic congestion that will take place tonight? He says the Parades Commission, in their infinite wisdom, says this caller, have given permission for St Gallen fans to parade from Shaftesbury Square this evening to Windsor Park. So you're going to have the normal traffic congestion that we've seen in Belfast over recent times. You've got some of the lanes for motorists closed and the Parades Commission have given permission at 5:30 tonight, peak time traffic tonight, for a parade to go from Shaftesbury Square to Windsor Park. So what's it going to be like in the heart of our city tonight for anybody trying to go up that road? We should probably ask the cops where the alternative routes are for us, for those of you that are, all you're doing is coming home from work. How are you going to get home from work? Will the buses be disrupted? All of that we'll try to establish for you this morning. The news is coming up right now. Right, the cops have given us a statement about this. I'm worried about this traffic tonight. Are you? Apparently the police haven't given us that. This is from our online colleagues. Our BBC online colleagues have got this. Let's have a look at this. Police have issued traffic and travel advice for road users. This is this. So what they're doing, just to sum this up, to get this into our heads. So the Parades Commission have given 2,000-odd supporters of this football team permission to parade in the city centre at 5:30 tonight, peak time traffic. This is going to be happening at the same time where you're calling us on nearly a daily basis now, telling us the city is in deadlock. Some of you describe it as a car park when you're trying to get home. So the traffic and travel advice from the PSNI is that the match is taking place at 8 o'clock tonight. There are in excess of 5,000 supporters expected to attend. The police say Boucher Road's also a thriving commercial area. Well, hurry up! Where is it in the statement they're telling us what to do? Prior to the match taking place, there will be a St Gallen fan parade, say the police. This walk will leave Bradbury Place at approximately 5:30. In other words, peak time. Couldn't make this up. It'll make its way into Shaftesbury Square along the Donegal Road. So anybody trying to get along the Donegal Road, getting home tonight onto the M1 motorway, screwed at 5:30 tonight. Screwed. Along the Donegal Road, into Donegal Avenue and into the National Stadium. Up to 1,500 St Gallen supporters are expected to take part. This is all from the police. Supporters, commuters and shoppers are advised to plan their journey in advance, ensuring they leave sufficient travel time as congestion is likely in the area. A build-up of traffic is expected to be in Shaftesbury Square, Lisburn Road, Donegal Road areas, South Belfast, as well as the M1 and Boucher Road, both before and after the game. We would ask those driving to the match, park with consideration and be considerate. The areas around the National Stadium are no street drinking zones. We hope the match is enjoyed by all. We'd remind those attending to behave in a manner befitting the reputation of their teams. I'm trying to find within this police statement, have they suggested any alternative routes? That statement essentially says, go early. Go where? From what? I promise myself, you know, I'm 51 now. I cannot get frustrated every day in this programme. I really can't. So here's what we're all trying to do tonight. By the way, I'll be well home, so it's not affecting me. Here's what many of you are trying to do tonight. You're trying to get home. So could someone somewhere, we'll reach out to the Department for Infrastructure, Mr. O'Dowd's department. We'll reach out again to the PSNI. We'll reach out again to TransLink. Is there any chance of someone in this country who has the authority, the planning, the resources, the information, tell us where to go tonight? And how does the Parades Commission sign off a parade in peak time traffic? There are questions for them. So look, I'm not exactly the brains of Britain. I ask a lot of obvious questions. The obvious questions tonight on behalf of everybody trying to get home. Where do we go? What alternative routes do we take? The police telling us to leave early. What's that mean? How early?
Are we advised to, if there is enough time, are we advised to abandon our car? Will the buses be able to travel? Big deep breaths. See, there are people who don't have the luxury that I have. There are people who can't say to themselves, oh, well, do you know what? I'm going to go home early tonight. So there will be many thousands of people trying to get home tonight. You think of that area, that key area around Shaftesbury Square. There will be people visiting their loved ones in hospital tonight at Belfast City Hospital. What do they do? And all we have here from everybody in power, all of them, leave early. So where's the planning around this and what do we do? 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call. Tony has contacted us about winter fuel payments. Morning to you, Tony.
Good morning, Stephen.
Oh, big deep breaths. Honest to goodness, Tony. You're the Secretary of the Northern Ireland Branch of the Civil Service Pensioners Alliance, and you want to talk to us about winter fuel payments, winter fuel allowances.
But yes, it is, Stephen. Obviously, when the Chancellor of the Exchequer withdrew it, it was a matter of considerable concern to us and to a lot of pensioners, not only in Northern Ireland but throughout the UK, because it was withdrawn at very, very short notice. But now that the executive have got the extra £1.5 billion in the budget last week, we would like to think that Gordon Lyons, the Minister for Communities, will try and give some of that money over to pensioners to ensure that they will get the winter fuel allowance, because it is a devolved matter. And in his statement to the Assembly on the 9th of September, Gordon Lyons said it would cost £44.3 million to pay the winter fuel allowance. So if he's got £1.5 billion extra, we'd like to think that the winter fuel allowance could be resumed for pensioners, because it is estimated that there will be a lot of pensioners will be affected. And I do hear people make the argument that, you know, very rich people get the winter fuel allowance and they don't need it. But the fact is that a lot of people do need the winter fuel allowance. It's a real godsend for them, because they are maybe just above the pension credit level, and they absolutely need it. And even of those people who are entitled to pension credit, the Department for Communities estimate that 28% of people don't claim it, which means at least 24,000 pensioners in Northern Ireland don't claim it because of a whole variety of reasons, the pride that they have or the complexity of the form. So the winter fuel allowance is absolutely necessary for people.
So what do you... Look, Stormont made the decision. They're hardly going to go back on it. Is that what you're calling for them to do?
Well, ideally... Ideally, we would like the Chancellor of the Exchequer to change the position for the whole of the UK. But because it is a devolved matter to the Welsh Assembly, to the Scottish Parliament, and to the Northern Ireland Assembly, each of the three devolved nations can make their own decisions. Now, obviously, whenever the Chancellor originally withdrew this, they all said that they couldn't pay it because they didn't have the money to pay it, because the UK Exchequer wasn't giving them the money. But now that this, all of the three areas have got extra money allocated to them from the budget last week, and in the case of Northern Ireland, that was £1.5 billion. Now, we absolutely understand and appreciate that there's lots of people looking for that, health, education and other areas. But pensioners, what you've got to remember about pensioners, if pensioners, particularly many pensioners who have illnesses that require the heating on all day, every day, which is a big, big cost to them. And therefore, in the winter, it's absolutely essential that they're kept warm. And if they're not kept warm, then they'll be put into hospital. And think of the charges that will cost. So it's very short-sighted, we believe, to not pay the winter fuel allowance.
Tony, thank you for raising it with us this morning. The Department of Finance have talked about the pressures previously identified, £770 million, they say. And they say, look, that means the extra funding falls short of what is needed and is not sufficient to meet the trajectory of overspend the department's vindicated for this year.
And they're saying that they're disappointed that the Chancellor didn't move to reinstate funding for the winter fuel payment. Thank you, Tony, for raising the issue. We'll continue to take your calls today and tomorrow on this 030 30 80 55 55. Peter in Belfast on this traffic mayhem that we're going to have at tea time tonight. Hello, Peter.
Good morning, Stephen. No, just having heard there the advice from the intelligent people, they would describe themselves as, they would tell us there to plan your trips in advance. So anybody having a medical emergency of sorts, they should plan these things well in advance, because that road is a main arterial route to two hospitals. And I feel so sorry for ambulance drivers and that, how they're coping with all this at the minute. I know drivers are concerned about getting home and all this. How on earth these ambulances manage to weave their way through all this traffic congestion? And then these clever people introduce this problem.
Well, the police are saying, and look, the police are just tidying up the mess of all of this. What can they do about it, right? So, there are questions here for the Parades Commission agreeing to this, signing off a parade in all of these arterial routes at 5:30 peak time traffic. I don't know when they signed it off. Did they not know there was major traffic disruption already in the area? I don't know, but it is signed off in peak time traffic. But here's the point, Peter, of stories like this. When you hear these statements, now this one from the police, ensure you leave sufficient travel time, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are many people who certainly I represent on this programme. I represent questions on their behalf. They're working in shops. They're working in low-paid jobs. They can't turn round to their boss and get a free pass to get out early. That's sometimes at the pleasure of all of these white-collar workers that can simply say, oh, here, I'm away early today. What about the people standing on cash registers and they don't get out to 5 o'clock? The people that are working on shifts and their boss would tell them where to go if they try to get out early. What are they going to do today?
Well, just you may find, actually, the people who authorised this are working from home.
It sounds like it's going to be bedlam, and there's no explanation. We've been in touch, or are in touch, with the Department for Infrastructure, so let's see what guidance we get from them. Where are we supposed to go, and why is this messaging not out there yesterday, or indeed from this time this morning, from first time this morning? What roads are we supposed to take?
Well, as I highlighted there, this is main arterial route to two hospitals. You have staff that have to work shifts, coming in and out, maybe leaving after working long hours.
Absolutely.
And those going on. How on earth are they supposed to get there? They don't seem to care. They tick boxes.
Now, the alternative here is, of course, look, these fans have applied through the proper process. We want visitors to Northern Ireland to be able to parade, rejoice in a football match, you could argue.
Yes, but we don't have the infrastructure for this. We don't have the roads for this. It's madness.
Well, look, Shaftesbury Square, Lisburn Road, Donegal Road areas of South Belfast, M1, Boucher Road, they're likely to be screwed or certainly badly affected both before and after this game, is what the police are saying.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people probably just have to go to their bosses and tell them, either if you're working the evening shifts, well, I'm going to be late, or do you advise me not to come in at all, or those who are leaving, goodness knows when they'll get home. So it's... But as I said, clever people who authorised this are probably sitting at home, working on a laptop or something, just ticking boxes.
Well, sitting at home might be the clever thing to do. Working from home is what it's called.
Anyway,
listen, thank you very much for calling us today. We'll let you know if the Department for Infrastructure have anything to tell you. Any planning by the planners? Just anybody coming up with anything? Next, Michelle O'Neill has become the first senior Sinn Féin figure to take part in an official Remembrance Sunday ceremony in Belfast. This was in the news yesterday, wasn't it? In the past, several Sinn Féin politicians have laid wreaths at the cenotaph in previous years, but they have not attended the main Sunday ceremony. The First Minister has confirmed she's accepted an invitation and she will lay a laurel wreath. She told the Press Association this is all part of her commitment to being a First Minister for all.
Well, back in February, it was a moment of progress and equality here whenever I became the first Nationalist Republican First Minister. And I made very firm pledges at that time that I would represent everybody in society. So when I got this invitation to attend remembrance events this weekend, I thought it was important to take that invitation up, because that for me is a fulfilment of my commitment to those people out there for British and Unionist identity who hold this important Remembrance Day, you know, very carefully to their own hearts. So for me, this is about acknowledgement of loss, but it's also about being respectful to all those people out there and fulfilling my commitment to be First Minister for all.
She was also asked if this was a way of diverting attention away from the recent controversy Sinn Féin's found itself in.
I took this initiative because I believe it's the right thing to do. I believe it is a fulfilment of my commitment to be First Minister for all. You can't escape the fact that the past number of weeks have been difficult for the party, and I've, you know, publicly stated all of that in terms of the public record, but this is not about that. This is about me fulfilling my commitment to be First Minister for all.
Chris Donnelly's with us this morning, commentator, former Sinn Féin election candidate. Morning to you, Chris.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. The former DUP SPAD, David Graham. Hello, David.
Hello, Stephen.
Good morning to you. And Denise Mullen is with us, member of the N2, whose father was murdered by the Glen Ann gang. Hello, Denise.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Well, David, if we start with you, this is Michelle O'Neill doing something for the first time. She doesn't have to do it. So should she be praised for doing this?
I don't necessarily think it's a case of should she be criticised or should she be praised. I think, in a way, Stephen, with respect, the fact that, you know, this is no longer really headline news. I mean, we go back to the days of Martin McGuinness meeting the Queen and various other gestures from Sinn Féin. I mean, these are obviously to be welcomed and they're the sign of progress within Northern Ireland. But, you know, in the same sentence, it is very difficult to be First Minister for all when, you know, I read from various Unionists of, you know, the wide, broad Unionist family who some are saying, well, look, I am a victim of the IRA, or I know people are victims of the IRA. Michelle O'Neill said there was no alternative to the IRA's violence. I think it's probably also a fine line for her to walk within her own party and her own wider community, and that, you know, people associate the poppy with, you know, the UDR, the army. They then link that to, you know, Bloody Sunday, to other atrocities. So, you know, this is a difficult line for Michelle O'Neill to walk. And I think in reality, Stephen, there will be many cynics out there from across the political divide who will say, look, Sinn Féin have had the worst 4-6 weeks really in their entire history since formation 1905. And, you know, from a PR point of view, and essentially this is a good distraction tactic, essentially, too, when there is an election in the South. So, look, it's not a straightforward answer, Stephen, to say the least.
Chris?
Yeah, I don't accept that last point. I think the trajectory that Sinn Féin have been on in this regard has been clear for many years. I think that regardless of the other stuff that's affected the party recently, this was clearly on the cards. I mean, after all, Mary Lou McDonald and Michelle O'Neill attended the annual church service in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin to mark Remembrance Sunday in the past. I think what is more important with regard to this is, yes, I accept that it is another example of Sinn Féin and with a nationalism willing to engage in outreach to, you know, this notion of First Minister for all. Yes, and there will be many nationalists out there who are saying the Unionists would never reciprocate on this. But I do think David's touching on something, and I expect Denise to too. This is going to be problematic for Sinn Féin. It's going to be problematic because it's ideologically very confusing. You see, it's one thing to do, as Sinn Féin have done over the last 20 years. It makes sense to say we will engage in remembrance to mark Irish people who fought in the British Army for World War I and World War II. Ideologically, that is acceptable to people because they see that that's a story that the country has been on. There are reasons that people fought in World War I and World War II. But the reason that they have always drawn the line with regard to Remembrance Sunday and the poppy is because it represents British forces who have fought not just in World War I and World War II, but also the Parachute Regiment in Derry, the UDR, the RUC that were involved in many murders in the North too. And that is why logically and ideologically from a nationalist perspective, that's where the line has been drawn. So what she's doing here, yes, I can understand, is saying, look, I'm trying to take outreach a little bit further. But even at that, she's drawn a line saying, I'm going to do what the Irish government do. I'm going to lay a laurel wreath because the poppy wreath is too far, because the poppy wreath represents British forces other than just World War I and World War II, in which case, why engage in the ceremony at all? Do you understand what I'm saying? See, I think this is something, David is right. This is something that is not going to rest easy with many nationalists and Republicans for the exact same reason that Emma Little Pengelly is not going to be going to an Easter Republican commemoration. She can afford space for that to happen, just like nationalists and Republicans can say there must be space for British remembrance. But engaging.
So if you're confused as to why it happens, Chris, does that lead you to the conclusion that it's a diversionary tactic away from their PR problems at the minute?
No, because the trajectory has been clear. After all, as I said at the start, both Mary Lou and Michelle attended the British Remembrance Sunday event in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. So it's not diversionary. I can understand she's saying, I'm taking outreach a little bit further. But in that, Stephen, and you've talked many times in the past in your show about when there are Republican commemorations, about the impact potentially that has on victims of Republicans, re-traumatizing family. But as I've always pointed out to you, the reverse is also true. When people are remembering British forces, there are people out there who have been victims of British forces, whose relatives have been killed. It has an impact on those people too. And that's the people that Sinn Féin will be a little bit sensitive around on this.
Stephen, could just add very quickly. Chris is right, because the narrative that's been set up by Sinn Féin is that, you know, there was collusion throughout the Troubles. And, you know, for example, the Pat Finucane inquiry is looking at collusion between Lords Paramilitaries and the RUC. Now, if you then were to say, you know, gestures are fine, and that, you know, Edwin Putz went to GA match as far back as sort of 2007, 2008. Edwin Putz again spoke Irish a number of years ago. There are small gestures that mean a lot, but if you actually consider the narrative here, this, if you look at it from a Republican point of view, is actually akin to Emma Little Pengelly going to a provisional IRA commemoration, because that is how Republicans have set the narrative regarding British forces. So Chris is right. You know, they are, in my view, and Sinn Féin and Michelle O'Neill is creating a problem for herself. And I'm not actually quite sure what the outcome,
well,
the desired outcome is.
Denise?
Good morning. Well, I can appreciate that Michelle O'Neill is going to the commemoration of the parade, and I mean, basically she's damned if she does and damned if she doesn't. But by the same time, saying that she's a minister for all, she has failed to take into consideration the victims, innocent victims of terrorism that have been affected by RUC and UDR. So my question is, has Michelle O'Neill and Sinn Féin addressed what the British Legion, how they deal with those within that are benefiting from their fundraising, etc., etc.? I'm sure they're not excluded. So I think it's a question for the British Legion as to what these, whether it be widows or widowers, are receiving from them, because I don't think in that it's right. And Michelle O'Neill not to have come out and asked that question is very, very offensive.
And you find it personally offensive, Denise?
I do. As a victim of the Troubles, there was 4 MOD and 1 RUC involved in my father's murder. He was the first killed by the Glenann gun, a gun that was stolen from an army barracks that to this day has not been investigated. So one of the perpetrators involved in my father's murder was later shot himself by the IRA, and he was in the UDR. So is his widow benefiting from the British Legion fundraising? Because I have difficulties with that.
And what would you say to the First Minister this morning?
Well, as she's saying, she's a minister for all, she hasn't addressed that, because there are several other victims like myself, so she hasn't been a minister for all for us.
Yes.
So her going to the commemoration is offensive for me, because she hasn't asked that question of the British Legion.
And Chris Donnelly, you talked about the mixed messages, you talked about the difficulties here. Denise Mullen articulating her difficulties with this.
Yeah, to be honest, I expect that. I expect that to be. And, you know, our two communities, and I don't like using that phrase, Stephen, but unfortunately sometimes it's valid. But our two communities are often quite different in how they'll react to these things. Often, you know, your program, Unionists will be up and Jim Ellis will be up complaining. There won't be necessarily voices articulated publicly, but I can tell you privately there'll be serious misgivings about this gesture serious misgivings, because people will see there is a logic in everything that has been done with regard to creating space and saying that British remembrance must be respected. There must be a place for it today and in the future. And in Michelle O'Neill's, in fairness to her, I can understand there's a difficulty if you're trying to define what does a First Minister for All look like. But she herself is drawing a line by saying, well, I'm going, but I'm laying a laurel wreath and not a poppy wreath. David, so she's acknowledging the difficulty.
But David Graham, just finally, will there be many in this country will ever believe there will really be a First Minister for All, given the party allegiances?
Oh, look, I think that, Steve, that's a fair question. I mean, in reality, as I said, and it really is a millstone around Michelle O'Neill's neck, but to say there was no alternative to 30-odd years of, you know, bloodthirsty violence by the Provisional IRA will always come back to haunt her. And I think, you know, it is very difficult for her to walk this fine line, to spin this plate. And I think, in reality, and Chris has pretty much touched on it, what is the real benefit for Sinn Féin here? She's never going to convert those from a unionist background, in my view. There are people within her party who she'll never sort of convert.
Okay.
Is she trying to sort of soften her image for the middle ground? Possibly, but that'll remain to be seen if it's an advantage for her.
David, thank you very much. David, Chris, Denise, thank you very much. Back to the traffic disruption tonight. We asked the Parades Commission why they made this decision. We specifically asked them, can the Parades Commission confirm if the current well-publicised problems with traffic in Belfast City Centre were taken into consideration? And the Parades Commission said the Commission recently received a notification of intention. So they're not making it public when they received this. Did they receive this after they knew about the gridlock in Belfast City Centre? Parades Commission not telling us. They're just telling us about the date of the procession, and they're saying the notification was processed in accordance with the Public Processions Northern Ireland Act and the Commission's procedural rules. Why can't they just tell us when the application was put in and if they knew about the traffic disruption? I've no idea what you're going to do tonight to get home, and we haven't heard back from the Department of Infrastructure. Maybe they'll make it public later today what we should all do to get home tonight. Thanks for your company, and we'll see you in the morning.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.